Hello, I'm Muriel, and I love true crime.
I'm Nick, and I am not a fan.
Thank you for joining us. Each week, I force Nick to listen to me tell him a story of a true crime. Welcome to Muriel's Murders. Today, we're going to talk about conspiracy, murder, the Boy Scouts of America, illegal stockpiles of military gear, rogue coroners, money, and the shocking death of Fox Lake Police Sergeant Charles Joseph G.I. Joe Glinowitz.
Damn.
For this episode, I read a crap ton of news articles. My new rule, or maybe my old rule, is if the information isn't common knowledge and it isn't in the Wikipedia, I'll give it a reference, but I can't be saying according to the Chicago Tribune like 1,000 times.
Yeah, yeah.
What do I look like, a scientist? I will say, though, I referenced a 2016 article Michael Martinez wrote for CNN called The Secret Life of G.I. Joe quite a bit. And it's a really great article if you want to get a chance to read it. So that was one I thought was interesting and had a lot of cool reporting in it.
But otherwise, if you read something in one of the millions of articles you read, you're not going to tell people where it came from.
I mean, I am.
Sometimes.
Sometimes. Yeah, not look, all the time. Hey, I look, didn't make it all up.
She didn't make any of this up. Trust me, this podcast would be so much easier in our life if Muriel just made it up and didn't do lots of research. So here's the deal. If you're a stickler and you're like, wow, I do not trust her, I need sources, this is what you do. You can write us a really mean email, Venmo us $100, and we'll send you a document with all the links.
I have all the links here for you. $100?
Yeah.
I was talking about this yesterday. You said $5. All right.
No, I've upped the price. Okay. If you're new to this podcast, welcome to the family. This is pretty much how it goes down over here. One of the things that we love to do in our intros is shout out the newest members of our Patreon by name. Each and every person who signs up, we love shouting them out by name. So today, that distinction goes out to Jay Bob. Thank you for supporting this show. We hope you enjoy all the exclusive episodes your brand new subscription unlocks. We've got two true crime exclusives and one non-true crime episode coming at you every month. So if you're like listening to this intro and you're like, man, I love how they talk to each other, like they're annoying in the right way, that would be entertaining or numbing for me or whatever, but I hate the true crime part of it, then boom, on the Patreon once a month, we just chop it up and just, you know, it's just us talking about, I don't know, normal things instead of Muriel's favorite stuff, which is murders. Okay, so anyways, sign up, lock in, and rock the hell out with Muriel's Murders.
All right. This is a true story involving murder, violence, drugs, adult themes, etc. So if any listeners are like Nick and they don't want to hear about those kind of things, please consider listening to a different podcast.
We tend to joke, we tend to curse, and those can be an upsetting combo for people, and we understand. Turn us off now.
All right, Nikki, are you ready to hear this story?
No.
Okay, let's get started. At 7:52 a.m. on September 1st, 2015, Fox Lake Police Department dispatch received a call from Lieutenant Charles Joseph Glinowitz. Joe, as he was called, was an incredibly popular member of the force and the little village of Fox Lake, Illinois, a village about 60 miles north of Chicago. Mm-hmm. So he was a 30-year veteran of the department and was about a month away from retirement.
Oh, my God.
In the community of 10,000 people, Joe really stood out. Mm-hmm. He had military training prior to joining the force and kept in excellent shape. He was super cut and he was covered in tattoos. He had one of those high and tight Travis Bickle haircuts, you know, where it's like shaved and then you have like the
little mohawk,
a little bit like a landing strip mohawk kind of.
Okay, so that's, I feel like that's old school classic, like G.I. Joe look kinda.
Yeah. And the locals called him G.I. Joe, like the action figure. That morning in 2015, Joe radioed dispatch from just outside an abandoned cement factory off Highway 12, just a couple miles from the police station. Joe was on his way into work when he called in to say he was pursuing three suspicious men on foot into the marshland off Highway 12 and needed backup.
Man, that's like, this is so brave.
Yeah.
It's like, there's three people. They're suspicious. We don't know why. I guess we'll find out. He's like, and they're going into a marshland, like the Illinois marsh. Like, I'm scared even thinking about that. I could never be that brave. If I'm not following suspicious people, I'll run from suspicious people into a marshland.
Yeah, right.
But I'll be like, hey, send the helicopters. I can't do this. I'm not going, dude. I didn't bring my boots. You know, I don't have a walking stick or something.
Well, his description of the suspects was super bare bones. Okay. He said just two white men and one black man, nothing else. No, you know, height or, you know, clothing or anything like that.
Uh-huh.
About 15 minutes later, officers arrived on scene to find Joe dead, stripped of his gun and his gear, and left to die in the swamp about 500 feet from his squad car.
Oh, my God.
Joe's death kicked off a massive manhunt for three presumably armed suspects in the area. It initially involved 400 officers, a fleet of drones, helicopters, police dogs, mounted police, as well as federal and state agencies, including the FBI. This was the fourth police officer killed on duty in 9 days. Whoa. In the U.S. at the time.
Wow.
So yeah. Joe's death made national headlines. It was a huge, huge news story.
R.I.P.
So Joe was a hometown boy. He was born and raised in Liberty, Illinois, less than 20 miles from where he was killed. After graduating high school in 1981, he enlisted in the Army, where he trained as a military police officer, drill sergeant, and sniper.
Yeah, so he was really about it.
Yeah. He joined the Fox Lake Police Department in 1985 as a parole officer and remained there for 30 years, rising to the rank of sergeant. He lived in nearby Antioch, Illinois, with his wife of 26 years, Melody, and his four sons, who kind of ranged in age from late teens to early 20s. Mm-hmm. Joe's big passion was running the Fox Lake Explorer Post 300 program. So Explorer Posts are, I think, they're kind of complicated in this weird way, but basically... Uh-huh. They're an offshoot of the Boy Scouts of America. So a co-ed program for older teens between like 14 and 20 years old. And what it does is it takes these groups of kids and it pairs them up with mentors from different professional, business, and trade groups in the community. Mm-hmm. So the Northeast Illinois Boy Scouts chartered Fox Lake Explorer Post 300 to the Fox Lake Police Department for local kids who had an interest in law enforcement. So it's just like a mentoring group.
And there's an exploration component to it. They go out in the woods.
Well,
and
they're
stuff?
Exploring what it's like to be a police officer. Oh, okay. Right. Or yeah, like sure, a firefighter sure. or whatever.
That
right?
sounds great.
Yeah. I had never heard of this before. So yeah. It's this longstanding program. It's been around for like 100 years or something like
uh-huh.
that.
God, would you have done that? I mean,
maybe. I mean, I think if you're in yeah. a small town and like this is a pipeline to get into a lucrative job, like some of like.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you specifically, like growing up in Seattle.
I just like doing plays, but I did a lot of stuff with
yeah,
plays.
Yeah, right. I guess that's sort of what kids do is you sort of, yeah,
you pick
I guess.
Something and yeah. you do it. Yeah, I did stuff.
Yeah, I guess that's right. Okay.
Wasn't anything that made me money. anyway, so Joe Glinowitz was in charge of running the program, and whoever runs Explorer Post has a fair amount of agency. So Joe's post was known for being super badass and more military style than mm-hmm. other posts because mm-hmm. that's his background.
Sure.
He'd have the kids run through complicated training exercises. He gave them badges and marksmanship, let them assist directing traffic at events, like all kinds of stuff, really hands-on. God,
I will say right now, I was not the high school kid to want to do that stuff, but now I'm like, man, someone should have made me do that stuff back then.
Yeah, that would have been, I mean, it seems pretty cool. So you can imagine he was a hugely popular mentor mm-hmm. among teens and their parents. He was a huge public figure. And again, yeah. it's a small town, so yeah, he's yeah. like the guy, mm-hmm. right? So there's this sprawling manhunt for three men believed to have killed Joe Glinowitz, and who police suspected were still roaming around Fox Lake, armed and dangerous. Unfortunately, in the first 24 hours, the search yielded nothing. Police didn't get their hands on any suspects. The next night, on September 2nd, though, there's a break in the case. A 30-year-old woman named Kristen Kiefer told police she was almost carjacked by three men, two white and one black, just about 5 minutes away in Volo, Illinois.
What? They didn't get more than 5 minutes away?
I'm sorry, 5 miles.
Still, 5 miles? Come on, guys.
Kristen said the
swim through that marshland.
Kristen,
you know?
Said the men ran at her, just ran at her out of a cornfield, but she managed to get away.
These guys, this is like a real life horror film.
And this sparked an emergency overnight search that lasted days with like roadblocks, more helicopters, hundreds more police officers. And there were a couple of dramatic moments in this search. Canine units took officers on a wild chase into a bog. After some deer.
They got bogs too?
Yeah, there's bogs and marshes, all kinds of stuff. And also, there were some officers who had some really fancy heat-seeking equipment, and they went out into a field and then found this like source of heat that ended up being an electrical box out in the woods. But the search yielded no human suspects, so it was kind of a big bust.
Yeah.
Afterwards, Christina Kiefer admitted she had made everything up to get some attention from the family she was nannying for.
Are you kidding me?
No. And I wasn't even the only. She was like, I just felt like I wanted to get some attention. So she did it. She got in a lot of trouble for that. She wasn't even the only one. There was people calling in so many tips, and there were all these false tips. Like, people were like, oh, I saw a bunch of men running down a field wearing black hoods and like just.
She wanted attention from the family she nannies for.
Yeah.
That was the object of her attention.
Yeah. It was dumb. It was dumb.
And now these guys, of course, they're not only 5 miles. Like anyways.
Right.
Yeah.
So frustratingly enough, right? Police again were left with no real leads. Throughout the investigation, tributes and vigils were held in Joe Glenowitz's honor. On September 7th, thousands of people attended his funeral in Antioch, including hundreds of police officers and the governor of Illinois, who ordered flags to half staff in the state. From the funeral, the crowd made an 18-mile procession to Joe's burial site, where they had live bagpipe music and put Joe to rest.
Have you ever been to a funeral that big?
Mm-mm.
Me either. Yeah. I feel like it'd be so powerful.
So it's devastating that no suspects had been apprehended at this point. And also kind of confusing. There was so much manpower behind the investigation. How could the subjects just disappear, or the suspects just disappear into thin air?
Yeah.
And because it was an ongoing investigation, officials were very tight-lipped about any information they had. Initially, they wouldn't even say if they had any surveillance footage or body cam footage. They wouldn't release any findings from the autopsy. By September 4th, 3 days into the investigation, officials told the public they had found Joe's gun near his body, but they refused to say anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And then some drama. For some reason, for some reason that is never explained, the Lake County coroner, Dr. Thomas Rudd, decided to make a public statement independent of the police. And on September 9th, Rudd announced that Joe Glenowitz was killed by one devastating shot to the chest, and that at this point, in addition to homicide, he couldn't rule out suicide as a potential manner of death without more information. And nobody liked that.
Yeah.
The commander of the Lake County Major Crime Task Force, George Falenko, was super pissed about that. Falenko had been handling all the press on Joe's case up until this point, and he just went hard against Rudd, saying that Rudd was jeopardizing the entire case by leaking all this information in what was clearly a homicide investigation.
Yeah, what's up with this coroner? It's like, is he moonlighting as a nanny or something and needs to get someone's attention?
Well, people were like, really upset.
Like, get me on camera, you know?
You know, and his whole thing was like, oh, I need more information. And people were saying, like, you're not the police. You know, you like, he was like, right. I want more information about the case and whatever.
It's like, come on, coroner, know your role.
That's what a lot, I read a bunch of letters to the editor that were super mad, and that's basically what they were saying.
Yeah.
The information-hungry public was a little split. On the one hand, the lack of information had the community on edge. Like, are these three murderers just like hiding out somewhere in Fox Lake?
Yeah, there's all these bogs and marshes, you
right
know?
And then on the other hand, angry letters, like I said, to the editors poured in, blasting Coroner Red, you know, like, how dare he question the investigation or put it into jeopardy. Nobody wanted the case to fall apart. Like, that was absolutely the truth. But really, at this point, everybody had an opinion. There were lots of opinions flying around, mm-hmm. and the lack of information wasn't helping to quiet the rumors. So these guys are beefing. And then around September 14th, like 5 days later, a third guy, retired Chicago policeman Joseph Battaglia, got in on the action. So Battaglia was living in the suburbs, following all the news on the Glinowitz case, just like everyone else in the nation. And
just a civilian.
Yeah.
He's retired.
Well, he's retired.
Watching the TV.
He got some big opinions, like most people at the time. And then he was just like, I am Spartacus. He got super worked up and he called straight up, used his phone, called Coroner Rudd, George Filenko, and like whoever he could get his hands on. And basically he threatened them. He told them, if you guys don't declare this case a suicide, I'm going to beat your ass.
If you don't declare it a suicide?
Yeah. He was just like, come out and say it. You're hiding it. You're hiding the real cause of this death. Like, this is a conspiracy. Okay.
He's completely convinced it wasn't a homicide at all.
Right. And he's like, why are you hiding this from the public? Come out, say it. Say it to everybody.
Okay.
He thought he was slick. He called from a block number, but he was immediately found out and arrested. He also got into a lot of trouble.
Yes.
Battaglia didn't have anything to do with the investigation. But
yeah, he's just making death threats.
Right.
He's
his motive, and he also ended up like not having a history of mental illness or anything. Later he was just like, it was just a really bad choice. Yeah, I should have done that.
Okay.
But you know, at the time he's motivated by this idea of just like, rip the band-aid off and just say what we're all thinking already, right?
And that's weird that that's what he thinks everyone is thinking.
Well, there may have been some legitimacy to those types of rumors that were swirling around. On September 16th, just a few days later, Ray Sanchez reported for CNN that federal law agencies had been quietly pulling out of the Glinowitz case as early as September 4th. The FBI, U.S. Marshals, and ATF had all just stopped working on the case. Mm. According to Sanchez, the U.S. Marshals said task force members were, quote, redeployed to other assignments due to the fact no wanted suspects or persons of interest had been identified for them to locate. Okay, well, they couldn't find them, right? And Michael Martinez later reported for CNN that within a couple days after Joe's death, through cell phone records, the FBI had determined Joe Glinowitz had actually been on the scene for 30 minutes prior to calling in for backup, and that the timeline, that particular timeline, eliminated all the initial suspects they had early on. They had a few people that were in the area, but based on the cell phone records, it actually didn't make sense. Then, on November 4th, 2015, after 2 months of investigation, the bombshell drops. Joe Glinowitz had been embezzling money from the explorers for almost a decade.
Oh, Joe.
He had used the fund meant for the teen program for family vacations, mortgage payments, gym memberships, porn, and Starbucks. According to thousands of texts and Facebook messages, Joe Glinowitz had also tried to hire a motorcycle gang to murder a Fox Lake Village administrator. And finally, yes, he had used his experience staging crime scenes for children to stage an elaborate suicide, painting himself as being murdered in the line of duty.
Really?
Yes. And this was obviously a huge shock to most.
Yeah.
But maybe not all. Because it turns out Joe had literally been wilding out since the 1980s. Mark LaBienne from the Chicago Tribune posted Joe Glinowitz's personal file online, so we'll just kind of give you the highlights of that. And it starts off with tons of heartfelt thank you letters from the community and letters of commendation, which, great, right? You can see how well-liked he was, right? And how, like, ingratiated he was in the community. Mm-hmm. And then there was the other part of the file. So right from the very beginning, when he first started as a patrolman in 1986, there were these, you know, little things like suspensions for faking sick days, refusal to obey direct orders, and then failure to appear for departmental meetings. He would do things like hand out citations and then give people the wrong court date to appear. He did it three different times. It seemed like it was malicious. He kept getting in trouble for that. Mm-hmm. He lied about patting a prisoner down. He just didn't feel like doing it, and then got in trouble when the guy pulled out a surprise knife and tried to cut his own wrists in the jail cell. In 1988, a fellow officer found Joe passed out drunk on the side of the road in his truck with the car on and his foot smashed down on the gas. So it was in neutral, but the engine was going at full throttle.
Oh, that's scary.
They couldn't wake him up, so they hauled him home and had his truck towed. And then when he woke up, he couldn't remember anything, so he reported the truck stolen. His file cryptically noted that this wasn't the first time something like this had happened. He was not disciplined, ticketed, arrested, or otherwise punished. Uh-huh. There was also another incident where, like, he went to a volleyball game and got drunk and then tried to call off work. And that used to happen. He was like, ah, oh, it was a volleyball. And they just, like, made this mistake. It's like all this talk about volleyball.
Damn, dude. The volleyball was just cracking in Illinois.
Yeah.
They were just going off.
Yeah.
I can imagine volleyball games. Like, I don't know, if you go out to, like, Venice Beach out here or something and you go to, like, a volleyball tournament, or down in San Diego.
Yeah.
I bet you that'd be fun as hell.
Well,
actually,
it's a party in Fox Lake.
Yeah.
He went on to do, you know, the same kind of low-level stuff. It's either there are these kind of big events or then this constant low-level stuff, like late a lot. At one point, he accessed computer records that he was totally restricted from that had all this high-level information. There was a point where, like, he was in charge of an active arson scene.
Uh-huh.
And but he needed to swap out a police car because he was just, like, trying to swap out this squad car. So he instructed all the officers to leave the scene totally unprotected before the people, like the investigators, got there.
Uh-huh.
So, like, that was a big no-no. Just stuff like that. That's a little hard to understand, I think, in layman's terms.
But yeah, I mean, it sounds like he's, I'm trying to relate to this as, like, a bartender or something, where it's like, yeah, you get in trouble for little things and you cut corners and you sort of, like, you know, beg for forgiveness instead of ask for permission on certain self-serving things. But then also,
$200 from the till.
Okay. So then maybe some of that stuff. But then also, it sounds like he's still failing upward. Like, he ends up getting promoted. So it's, like, not bad enough.
Yeah,
it's, like,
I guess,
in the normal realm of, like, how a badass cop would be or something.
Yeah. 2003.
Uh-huh.
He threatened to shoot a dispatcher twice in the chest and throw her body in a swamp over a joke she made.
Okay, that's pretty bad. What was the joke?
It was basically her saying, like, get out of the radio room. He was just, like, walking around talking, and she's like, we always joke with each other, and she goes, this is my space, and this is your space. The radio room is my space, and that's your space. Uh-huh. And he took offense to it and told her he was going to shoot her twice in the chest and throw her body in the swamp.
Okay, that's
and then
rough.
He came back in the radio room, I believe the next day, stood behind her with a large rifle, like a large firearm or rifle or something, and cocked the gun
behind
her. Oh, my God. She reported that to the police chief at the time, who we'll talk a little bit about. And there was, like, some mediation, essentially. And basically, Joe just said he didn't really mean anything by it. It was all misinterpreted. And he was just cleaning the gun. And that
in
was
in the
enough.
Radio room? Okay, great.
Then.
Oh, no.
In 2009. So, like, here's the thing. I read these files, and, you know, I skimmed some of them and tried to find stuff. But there's also stuff that's not in them. And in 2009, a bunch of his buddies from Fox Lake Police Department straight up wrote a letter to the mayor. So apparently there was a lot of stuff going on. The anonymous letter was 2 pages long. It listed 20 accusations against Joe Glinowitz. That Joe had received 6 separate 5-day suspensions for an inappropriate sexual relationship with a subordinate, after which she actually filed a lawsuit alleging Joe had coerced her into sex acts in exchange for job security.
Oh, Jesus.
And I believe it ended up costing the city thousands of dollars is what the file says.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly how. I don't know if she won or they settled, but they definitely had to pay her out something. Joe had been accused of sexual harassment multiple times, including his rep for grabbing several people's boobies at multiple department Christmas parties. He hung out in bars after hours were on duty to the point where several bouncers from different bars actually came to the police department to complain about Joe, like getting drunk, not leaving after hours. He skipped out on a $300 bar tab they were trying to get him to pay. The other thing he was doing was like cheating on his wife and going around town with all of these different women that weren't his wife, which, you know, I don't know if that's... It seems like not cool, but I don't know. It's like,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. He's just basically publicly living these two different lives.
Yeah.
Because when you were like, oh, he's beloved, in my mind, I was like, well, why, then why is he shady? I just don't think anyone can be beloved. That's my poison brain. It's just like, if you tell me someone's beloved and a pillar of their community, I'm like, no.
Well, people can be some things to some people and other things to other people.
Everyone,
you know?
Is.
Yeah.
So if you tell me they're a beloved figure of the community, I'm also like, and
dot, dot, dot.
But I kept my lips zipped because I felt like a cynic.
Joe also used his squad car to take his entire family on vacation in Wisconsin. He allowed the teens.
Oh, that would be fun as hell, though, if you're like, hey, dad's going on vacation. We're taking the work car.
He allowed the teenagers from the Explorers program to dress up like real cops and use the department's equipment and vehicles at the expense of other officers, like equipment and vehicles that sometimes they needed. At one point, he stole a gift certificate for a tattoo that had been donated to the police department and then used it to get himself a tattoo while he was on duty.
Just really double dipping.
And basically, they told the mayor, you know, police chief Michael Behan wasn't doing anything to stop him. They were just like, we're writing a letter to you, the mayor.
Yeah.
Because the police chief is just not stopping him.
Man, so that really makes it seem too like this isn't some sort of police unit or department run amok. It's like one guy.
Yeah, basically. Huh. Well, surprise.
Yeah.
The mayor didn't care and neither did the police chief. Nothing came of the letter. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason might have been this idea of being like different things to different people. While all this was going on, Joe was also becoming somewhat of an asset to the police department and a public figure, right? So first, he did a bunch of extra training. So he trained to work on SWAT teams. He trained to handle police dogs. He became a certified evidence technician. According to Michael Martinez's reporting, Joe was also, at the time, a member of the Army Reserves for 23 years, quote, earning so many military medals that they became too numerous to mention on his resume.
Damn. Yeah, so he's just like a workaholic. Like, I mean, he's just, how does he even sleep? What do you even, he just.
Well, you know, I think what my impression is that he does what he wants to do.
Yeah.
And then the stuff he doesn't want to do, he just doesn't want to do. So like he was calling in sick all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he finds the time to just not do what he feels like. He's doing stuff that he thinks makes him feel good about himself and then grabbing boobies. Like he's being, it's like he lives in the gray zone, right? Like he does good things and bad things. It doesn't matter. It's just like he just does the things he wants.
Yeah.
You know? And then over the years, despite his disciplinary issues, he was promoted to sergeant and then lieutenant. And his crowning achievement, of course, was the Fox Lake Police Explorer Post, a program that he'd been running since 1987. Okay. So he started running the program like 2 years after joining the force.
Yeah.
To the explorers, Joe Glinowitz was an absolute rock star. And over the years, Joe really took the program and ran with it. According to Lauren Zumbach for the Lake County News Sun, Joe was running the program like no other explorers post in the country. Kind of like absolutely unbeknownst to the Boy Scouts. They had this hardcore military style approach. Joe was giving out badges in advanced SWAT maneuvers and held a sniper course. On the group MySpace page, it showed a video of Joe showing the kids how to use flash grenades, and he would set up mock hostage rescues and drug raids on his personal houseboat for the kids to like go through.
And he has a houseboat?
Yeah. Well, he's embezzling all this money. And he was going rogue in all kinds of ways. Uh-huh. He wasn't doing any background checks on the adult volunteers, so like, whoever can come and work with the kids.
Not a good look.
The kids were sometimes paid to do things like run security, and they were paid by events to like direct traffic, which was in direct violation with the Boy Scout regulations. They weren't supposed to be getting paid for any of that
stuff.
He's
like getting them gigs.
Right. And then he'd take the money, put it in the Explorer account for him to embezzle later.
Oh, nice. Hell yeah. So he's just making money off of this thing.
Explorer fundraising was like the Wild West. Uh-huh. They didn't apply for any applications. They didn't follow the rules. We can guess why. Like, I read some text messages that he sent that are just like, oh, we don't have to worry about that. Fundraiser was all cash. You know, he's just like saying fundraiser and putting up a sign and then just like taking the money.
Yeah, yeah.
He gave his teenagers keys and 24-hour access to the police department.
That is so... What? Why? I mean, okay.
He let them wear, like we said, official police uniforms. So basically, they were marked as official police officers and then let them drive police vehicles. And he was just... They were just like letting... He just got to do it because he wanted to do it.
Yeah. Oh man, if he hadn't been sexually harassing women and like abusing the power that comes with the badge, this guy is so close to being awesome.
I mean, he's something. He's out there. He was doing stuff like somebody got a DUI who was like one of the people who helps him run the Explorers, and he just like let the guy go into the records office and like have access to his like records.
I mean, he's obviously abusing his privilege.
Right. Yeah. People would complain, like the officers would complain that when they would arrest someone in town, they would be like, you know, you better let me go or Joey's going to come talk to you. That kind of stuff.
Oh, no.
And according to Michael Tarm for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Joe was totally morphing under his power. Like, he started to refuse to wear his uniform, dressing only in military fatigues. And also, just for the record, the Explorers Post was supposed to be a volunteer gig thing that he did in his spare time.
Yeah.
He was still supposed to like actually do his job, but he would spend the majority of his day just running the youth program that treated him like a god.
Yeah.
And he could pretty much do whatever he wanted. The police chief wasn't really questioning that. And it was like some big open secret that he was acting like a maniac.
Man,
so unpopular in the police department by the end that no officers came to the party celebrating his 30th year on the force.
Damn.
The same year that he died.
I was just going to say, you know, can you imagine any job where suddenly one of your coworkers just only shows up wearing military clothes?
Yeah, you're just like, what's up?
He's like, what do you mean, what's up? It's
like, you should wear the uniform. We're supposed to wear black pants.
Yeah, or like, or like, we're accountants.
Yeah, he's like, well,
I don't wear ties anymore.
I'm not going to do it. And your boss is like, just let him do it. And you're like, okay, can I do it? No.
Yeah, definitely not.
Yeah, and then but then also he's doing volunteer work the whole time and not doing his job.
Yeah.
All right, so in March 2014, things started getting hairy for Joe. Okay. The village hired Ann Marin to work as the new village administrator. And her big task was to do a full accounting and inventory of the village assets, including the explorer's post, which of course sent Joe into a tailspin. Federal investigators recovered something like 40,000 emails and 6,500 texts sent by Joe. And like, here's the thing. They just pretty much spell out like, I took the money. Oh my God. I need to kill Ann Marin or frame her with DUI or something. Jeez Louise, this is bad.
If he had been spending any of his time doing police work, he would know that's not a good thing to do.
Everything is literally spelled out in the text. And a lot of the texts are between him and his wife, Melody, and their oldest son, DJ.
Oh, so his family's involved.
The messages show around 6 months before his death, Joe attempted to hire a hitman from a motorcycle gang over Facebook, which didn't work out. Surprise, surprise.
Was police just not using Facebook to solve like every crime back then?
I don't know. I think that I really don't understand how they have a bunch of drones and he thinks that he can organize a hit on Facebook. I just am like, that's bizarre to me.
Or write anything incriminating on any sort of electronic device.
Yeah. Well, so he either wanted Ann Marin murdered or he just wanted to bust her for drugs or DUI. When they were investigating into, you know, after they found everything out, investigators found a bunch of little baggies of coke in his desk, in Joe's desk, that weren't tied to any other investigation. So planting coke on Marin has been a theory that people have. It hasn't been proven, but that's an idea.
Okay.
So I'm going to read you just a couple sections of text just so you get a tone of like what it was like. So here's one from May 13th. He texts his son DJ and he's talking about Ann Marin and he says, quote, she hates me and I've never said more than three sentences to her the year she's been here. If she gets a hold of the old checking account, I'm pretty well fucked. And then DJ responds, hopefully she decides to get a couple of drinks in her and she gets a DUI. And Joe responds, she does, but not around here and no one knows where like she drinks. Trust me, I've thought through many scenarios, all in caps, from planting things to the Volo Bog. And the Volo Bog is like a big bog that's like in Fox Lake.
The murder bog.
Yeah, it's like this rumored to where you can hide bodies and stuff.
Oh
like
my
that.
God.
So he's like,
to your kid, you're making your kid an accomplice.
Well, he's into it. On June 26th, as the summer goes on and like things are ratcheting up, Glinowitz texts his son and he's like panicked, right? And he had loaned him about $2,400 from the Explorer's account. And just for the record, they say they haven't said how much money he embezzled, but it's only in the five figures. So it wasn't like a ton of money and he paid he would pay it back. Like he'd just use it as a bank account. So it's a very nickel and dimey in this way. So like $2,400 out of the account he gave to his son to fix his car so he could take a trip. And then he realized the account was like too low, like noticeably low. So like that small amount of, I mean, relatively small amount of money would be like something that somebody would notice right away.
You mean after doing it for what, 40 years or something, 35 years?
He embezzled for 7 years.
Oh, he only embezzled for 7.
He ran the program for almost 30 years, but he was embezzling for 7.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But anyway, that small amount of money is like a panic-inducing amount of money. And he tells his son, I need you to basically start paying minimum $100 into the account every month as soon as you can. And then he follows that up by saying, quote, so if called on the carpet, I can say we give our explorers and advisors loans from time to time if it is needed. And this is proof if it is being paid back. You get where I'm coming from. This village administrator hates me and the Explorer program. This situation right here would give her means to crucify me, all caps, if it were discovered. Mm. So he's literally saying out loud,
yeah,
I stole this money.
Yeah.
She's going to crucify me.
Yes.
Let's pretend that it's okay. Right.
Right.
Well, buddy, it gets worse.
Are you talking to me or him? Who is that buddy directed towards?
I think him.
Okay.
And maybe you. August 28th, 2015, after getting the runaround for over a year, Anne Marin decided to visit the Explorer Post 300 headquarters in person. So she goes to the Fox Lake Community Center where Joe Glinowitz had commandeered the basement without any paperwork, any authority to do so. He just literally went to the community center and was like, I'm using the basement now.
Okay.
Put a padlock on it, wouldn't let anybody
in. Damn. That's hilarious.
And there, in the basement, she finds an insane stockpile of unauthorized military gear.
Oh my God.
Kevlar, radio sets for tank drivers, gas masks, load-bearing vests that were made for carrying grenades and high-capacity magazines, hundreds of gun belts, bags of live ammunition, manuals for SWAT and sniper training for the Army, like a crap ton of cots and sleeping bags and like gear for sleeping outside, over 900 pieces of government surplus. Plus, drug-sniffing dogs detected traces of narcotics in the basement, and they also found like empty beer bottles and a beat-up, dismembered female CPR doll, or like, don't know what they did with that.
Cute.
Acting Fox Lake Police Chief Michael Keller later told Chicago 5 News, quote, essentially, the kids were being trained to kill on command. And I don't think that's the intention of the Explorers or what the Boy Scouts intended them to be.
Yeah, I would say not. So he was building a little militia.
Yeah, it looks like that might have been the case.
Who are these kids? Did any of them go on record and say like, oh yeah, we were Joe's army or something?
No, they just say it was like the most awesome experience. It was just fun. And Joe was amazing. It was really, really fun. Nobody really knows, I think, from what I've read, like what his intention was with all of that stuff.
Like, so this them being trained to kill on command doesn't seem like that was really happening.
Well, he was training them. Like, I don't think that he was supposed to be training them to be like snipers. And he absolutely was like training them to be military snipers. Like, I think there was some, I don't really know. The Boy Scouts they shut down the program, and like the Boy Scouts were like, this is horrific.
Yeah,
we would never, like, this is not what, this is completely okay. out of control.
Yeah, I hear you, but you know this acting police chief is not saying they were trained to kill on his command. They weren't being like radicalized in some sort of like, this is our leader way.
I don't know.
Yeah
I don't actually know the answer to that question. I think my impression is that it's kind of that thing where they caught him before the heavy stuff started.
Uh-huh.
But you kind of see where maybe the plan was being laid
out. Yeah, generally, if you have a huge stockpile of weapons,
what are you going to
do? Yeah,
that's definitely the calm before the storm. And you have a group of kids who's like super loyal to you that you're training in a very specific way.
Yeah.
And like you're trying to have a, I think people were drawing a connection between like maybe it didn't get as bad as it could have gotten, but like the plan looks like it's there.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So the way he got this gear, there's a program called the LESO or the 1033 program that allows police departments to acquire surplus military gear. And Joe Glinowitz had been forging former police chief Michael Behan's signature to illegally collect the gear for the teenagers he was mentoring.
That's so bold.
So, you know, Anne Marin wasn't aware of all of these technicalities at the time, but she's looking at this mountain of legit military gear.
That's just in a community
that's
center.
In the community center basement. And she's like, okay, well, this is a serious bad news bear situation. I can just tell by sight.
Uh-huh.
We're going to try to figure this out. Yeah. So on August 31st, the day before Joe Glinowitz's death, Anne Marin went to Joe and requested a full inventory of everything in the basement, every authorization and purchase order, and she wanted it by 2 p.m. that day. So Joe says, fine, no problem, you got it, 2 p.m. But he did not give those things to Anne Marin by 2 p.m. that day because he did not have those things. Mm-hmm. Instead, he made a last-ditch complaint to his former chief and protector, Michael Behan, over text, who had recently retired after being placed on administrative leave pending an unrelated investigation into his own conduct.
Okay.
I couldn't figure out what Behan texted back in return, but whatever it was didn't seem to help anything. Mm-hmm. Basically, Joe just texted him, she's looking into this and she wants the receipts.
Yeah.
And, you know, not really a can you help me, but kind of a can you help me?
Yeah.
And nothing came of it.
Yeah, this guy's like, I have literally so many problems right now. Me pulling you out of your drowning, you drowning in water is the least of my worries right now.
Right. The next morning, November 1st, 2015, Anne Marin emailed Joe at 6:45 a.m.
Damn.
Requesting the inventory by noon that day.
That's too early. Sending work emails at 6:45.
Well, he was supposed to send the stuff by 2 p.m. and he just ignored her. And
I'm saying you keep your professional side of the street clean. That will be a 9 a.m. email.
I think that what we're looking at here is maybe a little more serious than that.
Yes, okay.
Okay? So she emails him at 6:45 a.m. requesting the inventory by noon that day. Again, Joe responds, fine, no problem. I'll have it to you by noon. He got dressed in uniform, put on a bulletproof vest, drove to a convenience store, bought a pack of cigarettes, and drove to the abandoned cement factory off Highway 12. Over the next 30 minutes, he scattered a 500-foot trail of his gear from his squad car into the marsh, his pepper spray, glasses, and baton. He radioed in for backup, giving a vague description of three suspects, and then he used his experience staging mock crimes for teenagers to make it look like he died in a struggle by shooting himself in the chest twice with his own gun, once into the vest and then once downward at an angle from the top of the vest into his chest, killing himself pretty much instantly.
Wow.
After everything went down, Joe's wife, Melody Glinowitz, was charged with 11 felony counts of money laundering and misuse of charitable funds. She got a plea deal. She eventually pled guilty, and in return, she got 24 months of probation. At her sentencing hearing, they played a video taken of Melody shortly after Joe's death. In it, she said that, yes, they took the money, but they paid it back. Quote, people want to go, that's embezzling funds. No, not when you pay it back. Every time he borrowed money, he let me know and I'd write it down. There wasn't enough evidence to bring charges against their son, DJ. Mm. Joseph Battaglia, the retired Chicago cop who threatened everyone for not declaring Joe's death a suicide.
He was right the whole time.
He ended up pleading guilty and getting probation as well. He just said through his lawyer he was stupid and wrong. They never released what he said on the phone, but I wish I could find that out.
Yeah.
As for Anne Marin, she said after Joe's death on September 1st, she was harassed mercilessly. Like, it came out that she was investigating, you know, the Explorers program. Mm-hmm. She was absolutely trashed on social media. She was threatened over the phone, told by officials to take steps to physically protect herself. But then, after everything came out, she actually got a ton of apologies. She got people sent her flowers. Mm-hmm. People from the community were like, oh, I'm so sorry. Yeah. My bad.
Yeah, yeah.
She got thousands of positive emails. She won a bunch of awards in 2016 for city management, according to her LinkedIn profile. And then, according to Doug T. Graham for the Illinois Press Association, in 2019, Marin was mooned by a Fox Lake Village trustee in the Village Hall, which was caught on surveillance camera.
The mooning.
And then in 2021, she was put on administrative leave for creating a toxic work environment and later resigned.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. Man. So had he been suicidal in the past?
No. No.
He just never got in trouble. And then at the very hint of being in trouble, decided to end it all.
Yeah. It wasn't even that much money.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. It doesn't sound like she's going to crucify me and all this. And like, I get the stockpiling. I mean, you know, probably if they get them for embezzling of the things, and then it's like, you've been forging these signatures, but still, you know, that's heavy. And then also like, you want to end it all, but also be beloved going forward. Like this idea of, I want to seem like I was murdered in the line of duty is a move for people to remember you fondly and not question actions you had taken earlier.
Well, I mean, that tracks to me. Yeah. I think like, he spent his whole life cultivating an image of himself, and like a public image of himself that was like the end all and be all of the thing he was proud of.
Yeah.
You know, he was that guy.
Yeah.
You know, and then if the stuff comes out, he's no longer that guy anymore.
But he must have known that stuff was going to, he knew this stuff was going to come out. So then he said, but if I, at least if I die this way, people will still have sympathy for me and they'll be less likely to judge me harshly.
Yeah. I mean, probably.
That's heavy.
I mean, who knows? Yeah.
Who knows?
Who knows? I mean, he might have thought a lot of things. Maybe he thought, you know, it wouldn't come out.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, maybe the best thing he could think of was like, maybe this will save my reputation. It's just a last ditch effort. You know, there's also, you know, there was a few other things, like his wife, Melanie.
Yeah.
Because if he was killed in the line of duty, she would get, from what I've read, his full pension, his full salary as the pension.
Yeah.
So that was like $96,000 a year. So if he died in the line of duty, then she would get a lot more money.
But instead he did this, and not only didn't she didn't get any of that, he left her with a ton of legal trouble too.
Well, it's interesting because like, they gave her a really good deal.
Uh-huh.
She had all these felony counts, and even though she said, I don't think I did anything wrong, I was just confused, mm-hmm. they still accepted it, and she pled guilty. And if she stays like on the straight and narrow and doesn't violate her probation for 24 months,
mm-hmm.
she gets the felony convictions wiped off her record, and mm-hmm. then she becomes eligible to get his pension. So it won't be the full amount, but she still gets it, you know? So it's interesting. She kind of like got out of that.
Yeah.
Pretty clean.
Yeah.
I mean, not really. It's all very sad.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy tragic. I don't know. I don't know how much I relate to this idea of wanting a reputation, like a good reputation. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I guess I've just never experienced it. So if you've experienced what it feels like to be like adored in sort of a big public way, it would just be so unbearable to think of that being disgraced or going away or something. I care that my loved ones love me and that I love them.
I mean, I think you care about like living a life well lived,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Right.
And like, clearly.
Yeah.
This guy did not care about living a life well lived. He cared about a reputation.
Yeah.
You know, so like, imagine if somebody could take away your life well lived from you. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
that would be wild. Right. Like, that's your sense of self.
Yeah.
I mean, if somebody could take that away from you, you'd have like, and you couldn't say that that's a piece of yourself.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I think he's like a crazy narcissist.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, he lived a wild ass life. Yeah. I mean,
but
he's super...
also like, he's a big fish in a small pond.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he had the same job. He never had a job, worked at a different place his entire adult life.
Yeah.
He had one job.
Yeah.
He lived in the same 20-mile radius his entire life.
Yeah.
You know, he went and like got these awards and did all this stuff in this tiny situation and made a name for himself in this tiny town.
Yeah.
And then just like, you know, was like, can I control people? And then it turned out, oh yeah, I can. Wow, I can really get away with a lot. And he just kept pushing it and pushing it and pushing it.
Yeah. Man, that's a wild ass life to live. That's crazy. That's crazy. Okay, Muriel's Murders.
That's it.
That's it.
We have a button. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening. Muriel did all the research. She said she wasn't going to cite her sources, but you did. You did a good job. I think you did what you said you were going to do.
Yeah,
like you're
going
to cite specific ones, and then you're just like, oh my God, there's too many. Yeah, well, Muriel did all that, and I did everything else. So together, we're Nick and Muriel, the podcast producing team behind this show.
Mario Castellini did all our music. You can find him at Castellini Beats on Instagram.
Yep, that is correct.
If you listen really closely, you can hear our cat in the background talking. He's mad. I got him a laser pointer and I played with him right before we started recording.
Yeah, I don't know why you did that. We were like just set up, and then Muriel was like, oh, what Amazon package is that? And I said, I didn't know what it was. And then she'd open it up, and right before I pressed record, she just started playing with the cat.
And he lost his mind, and then the laser pointer had to go away. And so in the beginning of this episode, you might hear this like, So he's trying to figure out what happened.
Okay, find us on social media if you like that kind of thing. We're very inconsistent with posting, but... you know, it's still a good way to reach out to us. Our DMs are open. You can email us, murielsmurders@gmail.com. And sharing this podcast with the people in your life is such a huge thing for us. It really makes this show happen in a way that's meaningful for Muriel and I.
Yeah, so thank you. Have a wonderful day.
Bye.